Hello, everyone. This is Andrew. Welcome to Keen on America. On July 4th, 2026, America will be 250 years old, an anniversary that will, no doubt, be greeted with a mixture of celebration, contemplation, and resignation. In Keen on America, we talk to prominent U.S. citizens, not just about their country's past and present, but also about its future. What, I ask my American guests, will be the 21st century fate of their now venerable republic? If you're looking for the conscience of American conservatism, you might find it in Peter Wehner, the Atlantic and New York Times columnist, and a persistent moral critic of Donald Trump and Trumpism. So to begin our Keen on America conversation, I asked Pete, a veteran of the Reagan administration, whether he felt any shame in previous episodes of American history.
Yeah, in terms of when I look back at American history and the emotions that I have and whether I feel shame about it, shame would probably be too strong of a word. But there are elements of American history that are deeply troubling. And they're shameful episodes in American history without question, more than I knew growing up. It's interesting, I've thought about this question before, which is when I studied American history in junior high and high school and elementary school, what were my memories of it? What did I learn? And I think I was brought up educationally on an idealized version of America, not a false version of America, because many of the things you studied when I was young were true and spoke well of America. But I just don't think that I had the full story now. And I'd like to think that my sense of America now is more textured and more nuanced. I'm certainly more aware of the failures that America has had. So I think they're shameful episodes. But, you know, with the life of a country is the same as the life of an individual, which is you have to take them in the totality of their acts. And I do think that America taken in the totality of its acts, its achievements, are pretty extraordinary, but hardly perfect, that's for sure.
Should we historicize morality? I asked Wehner, can we use our contemporary morality to judge the goodness or evil of previous generations?
Yeah, in terms of whether one historicizes morality or whether I do, and this balance between objective moral truths, that is truths and moral truths that don't change over time because they're objectively true, then taking into account the degree to which you have to judge individuals in the times in which they lived, what the ethos was that they were brought in, up in, what could have reasonably been expected of them. How do you balance those? I think it's a complicated question. I think it's a complicated question because I think there's probably a tendency that I've experienced in my life to bend over backwards to try and make excuses for people who were engaged in what we would now consider to be immoral acts. Slavery is the most obvious example, most conspicuous, but it's not the only one. And you know, often you hear from people who say, well, that's the way it was done. That's the moral universe in which they were brought up in. So of course they believe those things. That has to be taken into account. No one can escape their culture or their ethos. Or the assumptions and propositions of a country and of a generation. And so that has to be taken into account. And there are undoubtedly things, Andrew, that you and I believe now that 100 years from now, 500 years from now, people are going to look back at and say, how could they have believed those things? How could they have countenanced those things? And you know, we're not trying to be immoral now. Just maybe that our moral sense is blocked. We have certain assumptions or things that we don't know. On the flip side, it can be used just too much as an excuse, as a justification, as a rationalization. And when, for example, in the context of slavery, you have people and you're brutalizing them and you're dehumanizing them and you're treating them as property, there should be a moral sense in people that's wrong. And then you go through and you read how different people treated their slaves, and did they release them or not? And you know, there's just a whole series of questions. So honestly, I go back and forth. I don't want to pretend that, you know, sit here on a moral throne and look back at every generation that came before me and said how these people were moral imbeciles. Many of them weren't. They cared about integrity. They had honor. They were courageous in many ways. But on the other hand, I don't want to make excuses for them. And because morality is objective in many respects, you know, we shouldn't pull our punches too much. I think it's a complicated thing, and it's easy to fall into one camp or the other.
I asked Wehner whether he agrees with Martin Luther King's observation that the moral arc of the universe tends, or at least bends, towards justice.
Well, Martin Luther King said that the moral arc of the universe bends toward justice. I think that's basically correct. I think that if you look at the moral progress and the progress of justice in America from its founding to today, it's moved imperfectly, fits and starts, toward justice. And I think that our attitudes on matters of race, on the indigenous population, the treatment of women, any number of other issues, child labor laws and so forth. Yeah, I think we made a lot of progress. That doesn't mean that we haven't slipped also from time to time. And I think America today in the era of Trump has slipped in many important respects. So this goes up and down. But as a general matter, I'd say that Martin Luther King Jr. was right. I think that the moral arc of the universe does bend toward justice. But it's a slow process, and it's slower sometimes than we wish it would be.
And Americans, I joked with Wehner, aren't the most patient of people.
Americans are not known as a particularly patient people, and that can be good because people should be impatient with injustice. I think the danger with being impatient is when it undermines, sabotages prudence, discernment, and wisdom, which can happen easily. You know, there is such a thing as revolutionary temperament that people can have, and revolutionary temperaments can get people and countries into a lot of trouble.
I asked Wehner whether he had a particular calling for politics. What drew him in the 1980s to the Republican Party?
My first venture into politics, you'd have to disaggregate it a little bit. My interests in politics go back to when I was a teenager. I just remember having conversations with my parents, particularly my dad, about politics. It fascinated me at the time. I remember, for example, I was a kid at the time, but Henry Kissinger, when he was the National Security Advisor to Richard Nixon and Secretary of State under Nixon and Ford, he was a significant figure in the American and international stage. And I remember reading about him and talking to my parents about him. International affairs interested in me, so did domestic matters. The Vietnam War had come to an end, so there was a lot of intense debates about the war, whether it was justified or not. My favorite class, and as I was growing up, was social studies. My teachers were liberal, and I was not because I had thought particularly carefully about conservatism. I think it was really a product of where my parents were. But I just remember thinking politics was really fascinating. And I think at a relatively early age, I did have a sense that politics was important because part of what was central to politics was justice. That isn't all that politics is about, but some core essential of politics is the pursuit of justice. Political science was my major at University of Washington. I did internships when I was a junior in Olympia, the state capital, and then I came to Washington, D.C. when I was a senior on an internship, and I interned with the Center for Strategic International Studies. And this is during the Reagan years, when Reagan was president. And then my first foray into government, I was about 25 years old, and I became a speechwriter for William Bennett, who was then Secretary of Education for Ronald Reagan. Pretty prominent cabinet secretary at that time, and so my entire career has been involved in politics, broadly understood, whether it's in the arena of so-called think tanks or in government itself. And then today, I'm a writer, an essayist for the Atlantic and for the New York Times, writing primarily, not exclusively, but primarily on politics, political ideas, matters of morality that we've been talking about.
What label, I asked Pete Wehner, would he use to describe his own politics?
In terms of the labels that I would have applied to myself, conservative is what I would have put on, certainly when I was in my 20s. I mean, I was working in the Reagan administration at that point. A lot of the people that I was reading at the time, whether it was individuals like Irving Kristol or James Q. Wilson or Richard John Newhouse any number of other figures, Marty Diamond, and then writers like George Will and to some degree William F. Buckley, though Buckley wasn't a huge figure in my own pilgrimage. I'd say George Will was larger, a little bit later, Charles Krauthammer. They were all, to one degree or another, conservatives. And Reagan, of course, himself was a conservative. So I felt very comfortable with the meaning and the label of conservative. And of course, conservatism has a pedigree that goes beyond those figures who were contemporaries of mine or a generation or two older than me. But you go back to Edmund Burke, of course, was one of the great influential figures in conservatism, and some people say he was one of the founders of conservatism. Michael Oakeshott in a different way. So yeah, the conservatism to me, as I understood it over time, was something I was comfortable with, and today I still consider myself a conservative. And in fact, one of the reasons I've broken with the Republican Party under Trump is because I am a conservative. I think the Republican Party under Trump is not a conservative party. I think sometimes it's incidentally conservative, but I think at its core, the Republican Party under Trump is populist, nationalist, ethnic nationalist, and dangerous. And in many respects, the Republican Party of today and Donald Trump have sensibilities and dispositions which I think are outright anti-conservative.
Wehner was involved in both the Reagan and the George Herbert Walker Bush administrations. Were these the glory years, I asked him, of Republican politics?
I think the Reagan years were, if not the glory years of conservatism, pretty close to it, at least modern conservatism, yeah. Conservatism in America, and as it relates to the Republican Party, I suppose you could look at the rise of Barry Goldwater in '64 as an important moment, but I was too young to be a fan or even to have followed Goldwater at that time. But I was never particularly attracted to Goldwater as a political figure. His message and his approach to things just didn't really resonate with me. I think Ronald Reagan was an apotheosis of a kind for conservatism in several respects. One was, and I think Reagan probably doesn't get enough credit for this, Reagan was pretty well-read individual, especially on conservatism. He understood philosophically what conservatism was about, and he articulated it pretty powerfully. Second is that there was a vision of conservatism that Reagan brought with him, which I think was tied in with his temperament and his disposition. And that was a kind of sunny, optimistic conservatism. That can be rare. I mean, conservatism has certain impulses and history of certain pessimism and even some dark elements to it. And Reagan was very different than that. And so I think he brought a tone and an outlook and a sensibility to conservatism that it needed, that made it more hopeful and more future oriented. And then third, of course, is that he won. I mean, he actually won the presidency. And there have been other presidents who had been to some degree conservative. Richard Nixon in some respects, though hardly in all. But Reagan was a real authentic conservative who won the White House and really inspired an entire generation, including me. I mean, I was a young guy at the time, and a lot of people that I know were shaped by Reagan. I also think, Andrew, that conservatism, as I was being shaped in my 20s, it was intellectually rigorous. It was about really thoughtful books. I mean, you think about Losing Ground on Welfare, or The Naked Public Square on Religion and Public Life, or Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind, or James Q. Wilson and Richard Herdenstein on crime, Irving Kristol as an essayist. So conservatism, as I was shaped by it in the milieu in which I grew up in, was about serious ideas, serious books, intellectual discussion. Antonin Scalia, in terms of the articulating a judicial philosophy, and all the rest. So conservatism, I think, was intellectually impressive, and there was a sense, I would say, at that time, of real self-confidence among conservatives, really saying to progressives and the left, going to bring it on. We feel like we've thought through these ideas pretty carefully, and we can have an intellectual discussion with you. One other thing I want to say about something that I think characterized conservatism to its credit is that conservatism understood the nature of the conflict with the Soviet Union and the Cold War. And Reagan was a fierce critic of communism, and describing it in terms of good and evil. And he was lacerated by the left at that time, a warmonger. And there was, or there were elements in American history throughout the 20th century, primarily on the left, who were quite sympathetic to the Soviet Union and viewed America and the Soviet Union through a kind of moral equivalence prism. And I think what we now know is that Reagan was right, and the Soviet Union was a wicked empire, and communism itself was a terrible system. And I think conservatism, in my estimation, can be judged to have been on the right side of that debate, and the left, not all people on the left, there were impressive anti-Stalinists on the left, but as a movement in general, I think the left didn't conduct itself in a particularly estimable way during the Cold War conflict.
Not everyone, of course, shares Wehner's optimism about the Reagan years. So I asked him whether there's any truth in the accusations by some critics of the Republican Party that the foundations of Trumpism, particularly the racist foundations, were laid by not just Richard Nixon, but also Ronald Reagan.
Did the Republicans make moral mistakes during the Reagan years, Bush years, or even before then? Yeah, sure. I mean, I would say on the issue of race, the so-called Southern strategy turns out to have been a pretext, at least in some respects, among some people, a pretext for racial appeals. You know, at the time, if you listen to the debate about about the so-called Southern Strategy. The arguments that liberals and Democrats made was that the Republicans were making racial, coded racial appeals to the South. The context of that was that Lyndon Johnson had supported the Civil Rights Acts, 64 and 65. And when he did, Johnson said contemporaneously, "I've lost the South for Democrats for generations." And he did in large measure. So what happened was the South, which was the home of segregationism, had been largely Democratic. I think Strom Thurmond had been a Democrat. George Wallace certainly had been a Democrat when he was governor of Alabama. But that began to shift, and the South ended up going more and more Republican. By the time you got to the late 60s and early 70s, there were not explicit racial appeals for the most part that were being used by Republicans. The question was whether there were code words, states' rights, law and order, and so forth, that were meant to be a so-called dog whistle. And I think when we look back at it historically, there is more evidence to say that that was the case than a lot of people would have admitted at the time. And the reason I mention that is that Lee Atwater gave an interview, and the interview took place in 1981,
and it was
released years later. And somebody was doing a history. I don't know if it was a history of the Republican Party or a history of Atwater, but in any event, they came across these recordings by Atwater. Atwater had been a hugely important political strategist in the Republican Party. And he was actually defending Reagan against the charges that these were coded messages to racists. But Atwater said that by the time you got to the late 1960s, you couldn't use the N-word and you couldn't make naked racial appeals because it would have been politically counterproductive and harmful. And so they began to use certain code words like states' rights, and even to some extent law and order. Now this is Lee Atwater making this confession or making this acknowledgement, and that carried some weight. Were there mistakes that were made certainly in that time during Reagan and Bush? I mean, I'm open to the criticisms. I do think that the idea that Ronald Reagan or George H.W. Bush of that generation were racists, or that the Republican Party was fundamentally or significantly racist at the time, I'm not convinced of that. I certainly didn't see it in terms of my own interactions at the time. The people that I worked with, the people I spent time with, I'd never encountered, that I can recall, anybody that I considered racist. And in fact, when I worked for William Bennett in the late 80s as a speechwriter at the Department of Education, my favorite speech that Bill Bennett ever gave was a tribute to Martin Luther King Jr. It was in Martin Luther King Jr. in the liberal arts, I think. But King was one of the three figures that really fascinated Bennett in American history. Lincoln and Madison were two of the other ones. So at least in the circles that I ran around, the idea of racism was abhorrent, and there was an effort to try and get the Republican Party on the right side of that question. Whether that had to do with Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, there was more resistance in it in the Republican Party than there should have been, but Reagan ended up signing the legislation. No party, no president is perfect, and I'm sure there were mistakes, but I do think that taken in the totality of their acts, the Republican Party was pretty impressive and has a pretty good record during those years of Reagan and George H.W. Bush.
I asked Wehner whether he thinks that the 21st century Republican Party of Donald Trump remains a conservative party, or has populism essentially replaced conservatism in mainstream Republican politics?
Yeah, I would say that now in the third decade of the 20th century, the main political story as it relates to the Republican Party is that the Republican Party today, in the era of Donald Trump, is, I'd say, increasingly fundamentally anti-democratic. I think it's a diseased and a dangerous party. And I think, as a on a second tier, if you were thinking of concentric circles, I think that's the most important concentric circle that we're talking about. But probably one concentric circle outside of that is the way that the Republican Party has moved away from being a conservative party to being a populist, ethnic nationalist party. And that the thing that really worried the founders, may have worried them more than anything else, was mob mentality. The reason that we have the system of government that we do, with the checks and balances and separation of powers, is precisely to try and calm the passions, because the founders were acutely aware of the dangers of a demagogue taking power and wanting to have a check on that power. And I think actually the wisdom of the founders was validated during the Trump years, when our separation of powers, I think, kept some things that would have been awful had they happened from happening. Especially, I think the courts during the Trump years held up pretty well. But yeah, the Republican Party today is not a conservative party. I think it's, in many ways, it's an enemy of conservatism, and it's an enemy of constitutionalism. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. I think this is now a generational change that's happening. And I'd say that Donald Trump's imprint on the Republican Party is at least comparable to what Ronald Reagan's imprint on the Republican Party was. And that's saying something.
Given Donald Trump's obsession with good and evil, I asked Wehner whether he thinks that Trump has too much morality or not enough.
I'd say that the problem with Trump's Republican Party is it is an enemy of morality. And I think also it's a battering ram against truth. I think there's an epistemological crisis in America that's being driven in large measure by the Republican Party, the MAGA world, as it's referred to, and Donald Trump himself. But look, Donald Trump is himself a man who's both amoral and immoral. Amoral in the sense that I think he is a clinical case, a sociopath. I don't think he's a person who has a moral conscience or can see morality or even understands things through morality. I think morality is to Trump what color is to a person who's colorblind. But then I think he's immoral too, in the sense that he uses his power and influence over people to hurt them and to do bad things, to do illegal things, to do lawless things. That's now a matter of record. That's not speculation. So Donald Trump himself is amoral and immoral. Then I think the real indictment of the Republican Party is that people who know better, who know what Trump is about, who used to stand for different things, or at least said they stood for different things, have rallied around him, looked the other way, gone sotto voce at sometimes, but for the most part has defended him and been his champion. So I think the Republican Party today is complicit in the immorality of Trump and the immorality of his presidency and his agenda. I'd grant you that elements of the American right can be moralistic and obsessive on certain issues, including culture war issues. But I think that the way that they use morality is so transparently cynical that I don't consider it too moral. I consider it a deformation of morality in any serious sense.
I asked Wehner what he thinks he brings as a prominent conservative critic of Trump and Trumpism.
I think what probably defines, or at least characterizes, my work as it relates to Trump in this political moment is that I'm writing about it through a certain kind of lens, a moral lens. I think that's just been part of who I've been since I've been a young person. And morality and questions of morality and moral integrity have just been important in my life. And when I think about the people whom I've admired throughout my life, people that I wanted to model myself after, I think it was almost always a sense of kind of moral virtues. I mean, I don't really remember having, desires to model myself after people who were wealthy or other things. I think, the quality of a person's life in terms of their integrity just has always had resonance with me. So I think that's just shaped, and it's really, I'm a product of people who've invested in me and loved me and helped shape those moral sentiments, however imperfectly I represent them and see through that prism. So I think there's no question that I felt, Andrew, almost instantaneously Trump was trouble. The first piece that I wrote critical of Trump was actually in 2011 in the Wall Street Journal. There's a piece called The GOP and the Birther Trap. That was when Trump was peddling this racist conspiracy theory that Barack Obama was not an American citizen. And I was warning Republicans, don't play footsie with this guy. This is conspiracy theory, this is ugly, and you're gonna pay a price for it if you do. And then when he got into the race, which was in June of 2015, I had a piece in the New York Times within 3 weeks warning Republicans and the country at large about what the threat that I saw in Donald Trump. And I would say that the thing, there are a lot of things that really trouble me about Trump. I think the thing where I feel most animated and get most upset is when I see these instances of Donald Trump using his power to hurt people over whom he has power. The gratuitous use of power, toward cruelty and toward vengeance, and just hurting people, hurting them through words, hurting them through deeds. I remember, just for example, when he got up and he mocked a New York Times reporter who had physical handicaps, and that really, really bothered me. And so these attacks on people who are more vulnerable really upset me. And it was, to me, one window, and there's so many different windows into who Donald Trump was in some fundamental way. So I'd say that's pretty high up on the list. I would also say, as a lifelong conservative, to see what he's done to conservatism and how he's pried apart the Republican Party from the best traditions, its own best traditions, and also the best traditions of conservatism, has troubled me as well. And I imagine there's some element of having been a lifelong Republican, to some extent having given my life to the Republican Party, and now seeing what it's been turned into, maybe there's some feelings of shame and embarrassment, sense that, should I have been more aware than I was of what was happening? But in any event, however that plays itself out, however accurate it is, a party that I had been a part of and devoted a lot of my life to is now an instrument to attack the Constitution, morality, our laws, and to tear our country apart. And so I think that probably explains in part why I've been as vocal as I have in this moment.
If Donald Trump is president of the United States in 2026, when the country celebrates its 250th year anniversary, then what? I asked Wayne. How would this look to the outside world?
President in 2026, when America celebrates its 250th anniversary, it's going to be a very dark and depressing and alarming anniversary, because America will have as president a man who's sociopathic and authoritarian and an enemy of the best ideals of America. And I have no question that if he's president in 2026, when America celebrates its 250th birthday, he's going to be attacking the institutions and the values that that have most honored America and represented the best of America. So if that's the case, I think we will be in the midst of a titanic struggle, an enormous drama. Without a clear denouement, we won't know how it's going to end. I don't have any doubt that if Donald Trump is president, there's nothing he won't try to do. I'd bet my bottom dollar that there's no line that he won't cross. So the question then becomes whether the institutions of America are strong enough to resist his assaults and the assaults of his administration. It's an open question. I mean, we dodged that bullet once before, but there was considerable damage. And we know now from what happened, the records, the history of what happened on January 6th, that it was a closer call than we realized, and that if a few key individuals had gone one way instead of another, things could have gone a lot worse than they were, and they were bad enough for sure. But you know, if Donald Trump is president when America is celebrating its 250th birthday, we Americans, if they're celebrating what is authentically best about America, will be celebrating an America that is contrary to everything that Donald Trump stands for and embodies. So it would be a 250th anniversary would involve a lot of cognitive dissonance if Donald Trump is president, because we might want to celebrate the best of America, but we would have as president the worst of America.
Finally, I asked Peter Wehner what he thinks Americans should be celebrating in 2026 and how the country can make itself a more perfect union in the future.
Yeah, I think the thing that America should celebrate at its 250th birthday is first and foremost what America brought to the world, which is the concept of all human beings created equal. The execution of that's been flawed for sure in America, as it's been in all countries. But that was a revolutionary concept, and that notion of inherent human dignity, human rights, was a profound one, and it reshaped the world, and I think it reshaped the world for the better. And that's something to take authentic pride and satisfaction in. Second thing is, I think that, you know, for an anniversary, a celebration of 250 years, of course you want to focus in on the great figures and the great moments in American history of progress toward justice, whether it was the founding or the abolition movement, or the civil rights movement, enormous breakthroughs in social policy. Efforts at equality, America's involvement in World War II, as one of the Allied powers withstanding the Nazis and Mussolini and the Japanese Empire. And I think overall, America, it's fair to say, has been a beacon to the world, an imperfect one for sure, but generally speaking, I think in the totality of its acts, a very impressive country. But you also have to take into account those dark chapters, which are very real. And in terms of going forward, where we want to be in the next 50 or 100 years, I think that the language of Barack Obama, which is, you know, that America is an imperfect union and striving toward greater justice within the context of an imperfect union is a pretty good way to think about it. You just need to take more and more steps toward justice. I hope toward civic and social healing, inclusion, toward compassion, toward moral order and moral sanity. And I hope that America can use its power to advance moral ends and to help advance human dignity at home and abroad. We won't get it right all the time, for sure, but if we can get it right often enough, especially at the key moments on the key questions, that would be a pretty good record and something to be proud of.